Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth. The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Attention! Attention, please, good citizens!
It is now 1 minute to 4 o'clock. Time to stop ordinary activities and prepare for the National BIM Hour.
All traffic must pull over and stop immediately. BIM exercises commence in 40 seconds. Join in the National Fitness Program.
Citizens, attention! Counting down to BIM Hour. Exercises designed for your health and peace of mind. All citizens must participate.
Attention, citizens! Shut down the machines. Put away your work. Get up and get ready for BIM Hour.
10 seconds to BIM Hour.
The National Fitness Program is watching you.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me this week are two of my favorite guys from the city of brotherly love, Eric Bressler of Cynadelphia.
Hey, Mike. I'm a big fan of both The Projection Booth and Oddball musicals, so I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. And Dan Tabor of Geekadelphia.
Hey, Mike. Big fan of the show, too. And yeah, I like really bad musicals as well.
I'm feeling a little left out here. I'm guessing maybe we can call this the Projection Booth Delphia this week, or just call me Micadelphia. Faithful listeners may remember Eric from the tempestuous Last Action Hero sequel episode, where he was the only listener to call in and actually tell us the movie that he would go into if he had a magic ticket. That movie, The Apple. Menachem Golan's 1980 musical that mixes stories from Genesis, Revelation, and Faust into one heaping helping of sequins, eye makeup, and disco beats. Set in the distant future of 1994, The Apple pits good against evil via slick music producer Mr. Boogaloo versus some damn hippies. So tell me, Eric, why would you like to visit the world of The Apple, and if you go, do you have your BIM mark in place?
You know, that's a tough call because I'm truly torn between the two societies that exist in the future that is 1994. The mainstream militaristic dictatorship that is BIM's America certainly has a lot to offer, such as giant champagne glasses, triangle-shaped baby carts, disco glam fashion sense, and a concentration on physical fitness as viewed in the National BIM Exercise Hour, held daily at 4 p.m. But in the underground, and literally the underground as they live in caves, dwell the refugees from the 1960s, commonly known as hippies, who cling to each other like the book-loving rebels of Fahrenheit 451. Now, their bland folk music obviously pales in comparison to BIM's genre-hopping pop hits, but if you live with them long enough, then, well, if you've seen the movie, then you know what happens. But actually, on second thought, I'd probably wear my BIM mark because I don't want to get a ticket.
true. Those awesome police cars with those huge lights kind of taking us back a little to Darktown Strutters with those police cars and their huge lights and incompetent policemen.
Sure.
Dan, where would you fall on the side of disco versus folk music here?
I'd probably go with the disco music because, I mean, those cars look like something that came out of the A-Team. Yeah, I would probably go with the BIM people. I mean, like a lot of the things Eric said, it just seemed like it was a little bit more fun, maybe because it's evil, maybe because you're hanging out with like Satan or whatever.
Yeah, the whole movie really starts on a bad note where you've got a music contest, kind of a Eurovision music contest going on, where you've got this awesome music number, you know, saying to do the BIM and dancers all over the place and just, you know, it's getting your heartbeat going, obviously, from the monitors. And then you get Alfie and BB, our two main characters, coming up on stage and doing this really kind of lackluster love song. And apparently that really gets the audience going until Mr. Boogaloo thwarts their efforts. But yeah, just I would much rather do the BIM than do that kind of lame love song kind of thing. So it's tough when you're pulled into evil so early in the film. I almost think they should kind of do something like that these days. I've got a few pounds on me myself. I wouldn't mind if every day at 4 o'clock I had to start dancing around and, you know, watch those nuns dancing and the police and everybody. And as long as I'm not on an operating table, I guess I'll be okay.
Very good. I wondered where they learned the choreography. It might maybe taught in school at a young age.
Yeah, the timeline for this movie is always kind of weird. It's like, how long is it from the beginning of the movie until the end of the movie? What kind of time has taken place? Because it seems like towards the end there, like years and years have gone by.
That was a little strange. They had the baby and everything. The choreographer on this was actually one of the producers of American Idol, of all things.
Well, yeah, and then he's the main guy on So You Think You Can Dance, Mr. Nigel Lithgow. And I want to say he might even have a cameo in the movie. It seemed like I heard his voice the other day when I was rewatching the film.
Yeah, also going back to the timing of the film, it seems like the BIM marks were instituted on, you know, one day, and then 2 days later, they're everywhere. It's a very strange pacing.
Yeah, the whole end of the film, too, with the, yeah, like you said, with having the baby, and it's like, when did this happen, and how long ago did this happen?
And that brings up the great point of, you know, the deleted scene, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on.
Yeah, which sounds like it was quite something. I mean, you can definitely say that no expense was spared on this movie, and it really comes through in the production design. I mean, there's nothing in the film that is not touched by this kind of Boogaloo influence. I mean, everything looks great. It just looks tacky. Just looks garish with all the sequins and all the sparkling lights and everything, and it's a gorgeously ugly looking film.
Yeah, it really embodies that 70s to 80s, you know, transition period fashion.
Gotta love canon.
Yeah, this was actually, I think it was a pre-canon film, but it was really gearing them up to take over the 80s. I mean, directed by Menachem Golan, this film was such a huge flop for him, and I don't think he's made another musical since. He had made a musical before. He had made one in, I think it was 76, Casablanca, but yeah, since then, not a whole lot of musicals from Menachem Golan, and much more exploding vehicles and shooting up people. And I mean, I really don't know how you can encapsulate the canon, as it were, in just a few words. But oh my God, yeah, quite a different school of filmmaking Golan went into afterwards. Tell me, you guys, how were you first exposed to this movie? I'm going to go with you, Eric, first.
I wasn't exposed to it until, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, just prior to its DVD release, when word got out that it was finally getting an official release. You know, a bootleg made its way into my hands. And as a connoisseur of kind of bad oddball musicals, I was surprised that I had never heard of it. And, of course, was immediately impressed.
What other kind of bad oddball musicals could you recommend to folks who enjoy The Apple?
From around that same time period, I could say Can't Stop the Music, kind of new wave-oriented things like Feel the Motion, Get Crazy. And then, you know, there's a lot of great 70s, more mainstream musicals that are kind of strange, like, you know, Tommy and, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, things like that, that I always liked.
Yeah, I'm a kind of a fan of Lost Horizon, the musical. And what's that other one? There's the one where they get, Old Calcutta. Yes.
I should also shout out Journey of the Rock Aliens with Pia Zadora.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic film.
Yeah, and another rockin' soundtrack.
This one had always been on my peripheral. I mean, I'm a big Can't Stop the Music fan. We actually had a bunch of friends over and watched that all together a couple of months ago. It's one of those movies that you bring out every once in a while and say, you kind of have to see this. And I know these both came out, I think, at the same year even. And this had been, like, you know, the one that actually made more money than The Apple. So I'd always been meaning to check it out. So this kind of gave me a reason to finally sit down and watch it. And it was actually kind of I found it a little difficult to acquire a copy, too.
Yeah, for a lot of years, it was really tough. It was easier to find the soundtrack album than to find the movie. For me, I actually really like a lot of the songs. I don't know if that's good or bad or what, but I mean, kind of dig Speed. I really like the Do the Bim song. As I said, I'm not a big fan of more of the folky stuff that's on there. And then I enjoy I'm Coming quite a bit because I'm a big Donna Summer fan. And I kind of sounds like Sergio Moroder on the production going on there. So, but I think that song might have some sort of like a double entendre going on to it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, very subtle song.
The thing that I like about the movie is that you've got Alfie and Bebe as your main characters, but they're really so secondary to the story. I mean, I follow Mr. Boogaloo and what he's doing, and then it's all about the sub-characters for me, Pandy, Dandy, and Shake. I find Pandy and Dandy to be much more interesting and charismatic than Alfie and BB. I don't know about you guys.
Shake scared me a little bit.
Scared you in that, like, where there's unnatural stirrings going on? Or
no. I want to be in a dark alley with Shake.
Yeah, I think Pandy is really maybe one of two characters that has an actual arc in the film. I actually like it when she turns good. I think The Apple starts to feel like a legitimate movie when she makes that transition. Dandy kind of comes across as like a sleazy Davy Jones.
He reminded me a little bit of Roger Daltrey for some reason, but much more evil Roger Daltrey. So I wish that I could see him as a Davy Jones character. Do you guys think that they were maybe like the flavors of the month before Alfie and BB came along?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, in the plot of the film, sure.
With what Mr. Boogaloo did to them, I mean, what he did with BB, I could totally see them becoming what, I guess, the next flavors. And it seemed like he was kind of primping them both to be that.
And they both seemed disposable. You know, they were like one-dimensional rock stars, so I think the point got across.
My other favorite part of the movie is when Alfie has his visions, these very dark, crazy visions of what's really going on in the film. And those are just so overproduced and just insane. I mean, it really reminds me of one of these kind of like a rapture exploitation film where you get to see what's really going on behind the scenes. And that's the one thing I really like about this movie too, is just how disposable the evil is. I mean, you know, everyone wearing these Mark of the Beast, as it were, and just kind of like, okay, sure, you know.
It's like a not so subtle Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, those scenes, his like apocalyptic visions, they kind of transcend foreshadowing. It's almost like, you know, a narrator's telling you, hey, things are going to go bad. Don't sign that contract.
Things are going to go really bad.
It just left me a little disappointed at the end, though, because I was expecting something a little more grandeur at the end with all that. But it kind of like petered out a little bit with, like, you know, the car showing up.
That ending is anything but disappointing. It's probably in my top 10 favorite endings of all time.
I didn't expect it. I'll give it that. And I was like, wow, this turned into a rapture movie.
All right, we're going to take a break and we'll be back with interviews from a number of the folks involved in The Apple.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolicDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolicDB10. That's DiabolicPB10. Visit DiabolicDVD.com today.
This is Mo. He seems to have his life together, doesn't he? He has a job, a scooter, and a house in the woods with a crawl space full of dolls' heads and empty beer cans. He's an all-American. But Mo, like so many others, is hiding a debilitating affliction. He's literally unable to stop himself from watching really bad movies. I'm deadly serious. Left to his own devices, Mo can consume up to 15 truly horrendous motion pictures in under a day. His addiction reached its low point when his friend Bosch spent almost 3 days incapacitated under a pile of black clamshell VHS cases, surviving off nothing but old stale junior mints, and Mo barely noticed. There is hope, however, and you can help. For just no money at all, you can download an episode of the Drunk on VHS podcast on iTunes or drunkonvhs.blogspot.com. $0 is all it costs to subscribe to all the episodes and possibly, who knows, even save a child. A disease like this can never hope to be cured, but it can be controlled and carefully managed in small doses, or as scientists call them, podcasts. We here at the Second Unit Podcast Network are bringing together people like Mo and giving them a forum in which to safely cope with their addiction. Donate by downloading the Drunk on VHS podcast today and support just one of the many members of the Second Unit Podcast Network. Thank you.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
How are you?
Songwriter Kobe Recht.
I spent most of the 70s in Europe, in Amsterdam and Paris. And the first label that signed me in Paris back in 75 was Barclay. And Eddie Barclay was the guy who really discovered Piaf and Chappelle. And he was Mr. Music, and he discovered Aznavour. And everything that's got to do with music of the 50s and 60s and still 70s. And he signed me for 5 years and put a lot of money and I had some great hits with him. But then I wasn't happy with the attitude, with his personal attitude. See, I got this problem, and it's got, with my name, which is Recht, which is right in Dutch, and that's a problem, especially in the 21st century. I'm a moral guy, and I never did like the behind the scene of showbiz. I've been on the stage since I was 9 years old, and the first big role that I got was from Menachem, who had a children's theater at that time, and I was his star for a couple of years, and then I moved and signed with CBS Paris, and that was much better, and I sold a lot of records there. We had a big hit in Mexico, but then finally I was married to Iris then, who co-wrote the story with me and the lyrics of The Apple, and we decided that it was enough for us with Paris and that we want to go back to Israel and have our boy.
Kobe and I, we were married at the time and we were living in France.
Songwriter Iris Recht.
We wrote it there in Paris, and then we came back to Israel with the musical in Hebrew, because Kobe was already known in Israel, and I was too.
It dealt with the relationship between God and the devil only. It was like three acts of relationships between God and the devil.
And then he decided actually to let Menachem Golan, the director and the producer, look at it. So he called him and he said, I have this manuscript of a nice musical, nice songs, good story and stuff. When we wrote it, we kind of fantasized about lots of things happening, but it was such a big, big, big production. And at the time, nobody had the budget to do those kind of things in Israel, like a big, big, grand musical with heaven and hell really there on stage.
You know, all the dialogues were written, and by then we had the demos of about 17 songs.
And Golan looked at it, and at the same night he called us, and he said, well,
I need to direct it and produce it. That's all I want. It's, for me, it's like Tommy for Ken Russell, and please come to Los Angeles. And
what you got to do is turn it into English, translate it, and actually adapt it into English, and then we'll make a movie out of it. And he invited us to actually come to his villa in Los Angeles.
That was the first time that I was in the U.S., and it was 79, and I realized that all the songs and the plot and everything is, you know, even if Broadway or no Broadway or movie, or this is just, it was out of touch, out of date, and everything was from scratch. Nothing remained from the original Hebrew version. Totally different, except for the name, The Apple. Nothing remained, not one song, not one. The plot was totally changed, because, you know, it was the time when New Wave started. And I told Menachem, listen, this is not going to work in the States, and I need to be writing the whole thing from scratch, and, you know, all the songs and the plot and everything. He bought his first house in Cheviot Hills, and it was a huge house, and he said, you live there. And he bought the studio, recording studio for me with all the equipment and stuff. And he said, I'll stay with your arm and I'll come visit you once a week and you just sit and write. And that's what I did. It was very fast, like in about 3 weeks, Iris came over and we rewrote the whole thing. And it was like six drafts that we had. And finally, Menachem said he wanted to hire some American guy to make it more slangish and, to adapt the lyrics and dialogues to Americanize them and sort of put it in there and trade magazines. And the first one who came to the meeting was George Clinton. It was really a click from the 5-10 minutes we talked and, you know, I really had great communication with him. It was like, for me, it was obvious that I wanted him to do the job.
It was an education for everybody involved in it.
Composer George S. Clinton.
I knew this woman named Kathy Doyle, who was a secretary. She was Menachem's secretary at Canon. And they were looking for somebody. She was aware of my career. I've been a songwriter, recording artist prior to starting in films. She was aware of that part of my career, Kathy was, and we were friends. And so anyway, she recommended me to Menachem when he said he wanted to find somebody here to help. Initially, it was with the lyrics, to make sure that, you know, that the lyrics were, as Menachem said, Americanized. Although, you know, Iris' English is great, and so is Kobe. So it was, you know, I think he was just trying to make it as commercial as he possibly could. So he wanted to hook them up with an American songwriter.
And I remember I walked into Menachem's office and I said, I think we got the guy who's going to do it. You remember he shouted at me, we have 100 more. What do you need? This is the first one. I said, talk to this guy and see, because, my intuition tells me, you know, that he's the right person. And finally he came into the room and he signed and he got the job and we started working.
So I would go over to this house where they were and we would work, usually in the afternoons and evenings. Ultimately, after we got the songs in, you know, we had a little tape recorder there and we would get them in pretty good shape and then go in and do demos of them. And I was a singer, so I sang all the parts. Somewhere, I guess there's a recording of me singing all the roles. But that's sort of the way that we dealt with the lyrics, is just sitting right there together, you know, coming up with stuff. But as I said, it was not broken English. It was simply me tweaking them. And in some places, they didn't have second verses or, you know, they needed to expand it.
You know, we finished like, I don't know, like 50% of the songs. And then Menachem got so excited.
After he saw Kobe and Iris and I were all working well together, he said, do you have a passport? And I said, yes, I do. Good, we're leaving Tuesday, going to London. And so the next Tuesday, we were all on an airplane flying to London, and I spent, the better part of 2 months living in a flat with Menachem and Kobe while we auditioned actors and recorded ultimately recorded the score.
Then Golan himself came into the picture and actually changed quite a lot of the script and made it, you know, a bit more comical and a bit more, what he wanted, all right?
Everything was okay, apart from the fact that when I rewrote the new version of the movie, I had in mind it should have happened in 84 so that it would be very Orwellian and dark and, you know, gray, and Big Brother, like Boogaloo, was, you know, show business through all the world with that. But he didn't like it. He changed it, pushed it back to 94. He said it's too close. And that was the minute my first doubt happened then. This was a weak point, and nothing helped. Nothing helped.
We were able to continue to make sure that the music was as good as we could possibly make it. But at that point, the idea of the film and the approach towards the film became Menachem. And so I think that's where it began to become something other than what, you know, we had envisioned. And certainly Kobe and Iris came up with this concept and had this thing in their mind much longer than even I had. So I'm sure that they're ambivalent about the way that Menachem ultimately delivered it.
It was a very adventurous kind of time because we were actually happy for it to get produced and everything, but we didn't like very much what he did with the story and what he did with the whole concept. I don't remember how long it took, but it took quite some time between that and the shooting itself, because he kind of collected the whole crew from all over the world and started to audition people.
We had auditioned a lot of different people, and it was crazy. I mean, people came from all over to be there, and there were so many people. It was an open audition that they elected me to go out and say, look, we're looking for a very specific kind of characters, and if we stop you halfway through your song, please don't take it as disrespectful. It's simply that we've got a lot of people to see, and we know specifically what, you know, we're looking for. And that pretty much worked, except for one guy who had driven all night from Wales. And he informed us that, after I tried to stop him, that we were going to sit there and listen to him finish his goddamn song. So we did, but it was really crazy. I mean, it was just an amazing experience. The woman that we found to play Bibi, Mary Catherine Stewart, was there with her parents, I think, visiting England, and she's primarily a dancer. I don't know if she was going to some sort of dance classes in London or if they were just there on vacation.
So I was living in London studying dance. I was training as a dancer in this performing arts school.
Actress Catherine Mary Stewart.
I was on my way to class and these classmates of mine were going in the opposite direction, which I found curious. So I asked them what they were doing. They said, oh, we heard about this dance audition for this movie, and we thought we'd just go ahead and do it. So I went along with them. I mean, it was literally that, and I danced it away. Nigel Lithgow, do you know who he is, was the choreographer. You know, it was one of these cattle call dance auditions. I was in there flipping around, doing my thing, and that's when Menachem discovered me.
We had these auditions in London for about a week, and we saw some 1,000 people, like actors, dancers, singers. And there was one day that was just for dancers. There were about 200 of them. It was a huge hall, Churchill House. And I remember there was a podium there, and I just stepped on it, you know, to see the people, the dancers and everything. And, you know, the second that I spotted Kathy, and she was, 19, I think, or something. And the minute I saw her, that was BB that I had in mind when I wrote the movie. And so I called Menachem Golan to the podium to see her, and he was fascinated.
He literally framed me with his fingers, you know, as directors do when they are setting up a shot. I'm dancing away, and he's like looking at me between his fingers. I'm like, what the heck's going on here?
And he said, there's a room downstairs with a piano. Just take it downstairs and see if she can sing. And if she can, then we're going to sign her. Because she's perfect. She looks amazing. And we went down to that room, and I knew right then that, you know, she was not a bad singer, okay, really. But, you know, I knew she would not deliver the songs that she had to do in the movie.
I would not call myself a professional singer. I'm an actor that sings, is what I would say. Like I said, I was going to this performing arts school, and I've always sung. I've always been like a singer, at least in my mind. And even at this performing arts school that I was going to in London, England, we were singing, and I was taking private singing lessons every week. Everyone else in the movie, Alan Love, Grace Kennedy, George Gilmore, they were all professional singers. Some of the songs required quite a bit from a singer.
I just want you to do the main part. And I said, don't you worry. I'll be with you all the way, and I'll help you as much as I can, and you'll do it. And I went to Menachem, and I had the courage to tell him that she's a great singer. So he said, okay, great. So let her come Saturday to the place we rented in Chelsea.
And next thing I knew, I was singing for him and reading from the script. And, you know, within a couple of days, I was basically cast. It was pretty funny. They were a little nervous about me because I didn't have that kind of solid background. I hadn't been singing for years and years and years on a professional level. So they ended up setting me up with a trainer as well, a singing teacher. I worked with him on the songs for, I don't know how long, a few weeks, and we were getting ready to record them, and the singing teacher was like, yeah, she's totally ready for it. But Menachem and Yoram, they got cold feet because, you know, and I don't blame them, frankly. They were putting a lot of money and time into this thing, and they wanted it to be the best they could, so they ended up bringing over a wonderful singer from Los Angeles.
Mary Catherine Stewart was not primarily a singer, and so it was obvious we were going to have to do something. And I had remembered a woman that I'd heard sing at a Christmas party named Mary Hyland, and she just blew me away at that party and the year before. And so I told Menachem, I said, you know, I need to get in touch with this person. And so he said, go ahead and do it. She sent over some stuff. I sent her some songs. She sent back a tape of her singing them, and everybody agreed she was the voice. So Menachem flew her over to do the singing.
And we brought over Mary Hyland, great singer lady. That she sang part of the songs on the demos we did in L.A. But I should say in his favor that he gave me such an amazing budget for the soundtrack, because he loves music, and he said, the music is the queen. And you give me the best soundtrack. And well, one session I remember I had like over 200 people in this huge studio in Wembley. It was the Philharmonic and the Ambrosia Choir, which is like 120 people. And then in this booth we put all the rhythm section musicians this was an amazing session. And at the same day in the afternoon, we recorded this reggae, How to Be a Master, with some Jamaican guys, you know, that they could not even read the charts. So there was no way that I mean, it took some time for them to record it because there's no punching and there's no from the start. So it was really an amazing period musically for me. It was just great.
Yeah, it was at the old Delane Lee, which is now, I guess, a parking lot for the Wembley Soccer Stadium. But it was where it was a great old studio where they recorded all the James Bond movies. What was at that time, early on in the project, considered by both of us to be a dream project. And both of our attitudes towards the music was that there would be no compromise. You know, we would go for the best that we could possibly get. And the engineer that we used, Richard Greenblatt, was really great, too.
I recorded it in London in Wembley at the MCP, which is one of the best studios there, a huge studio, and with my friend Richard Goldberg, who did the ELO and Leo Sayer and a lot of great artists, Simon Garfunkel. And then I had to remix the sound for the movie, the soundtrack on Dolby Stereo. And that was the time when the Nikon, the first computer of the Neve console, got out, and when I came to LA, there was only one studio in Los Angeles, the Village Recorder in Santa Monica, that had the Nikon, and I had all the details of the score, you know, printed on the disc of the Nikon, and so I had to hire the Village, and the Village at that time charged $7,000 a day. That Menachem had to send a messenger with the $7,000 every morning. I was in the studio, and I hired Joe Fine, who used to be Bob Dylan's engineer, and you know, the best studio I've ever worked in was the Village Recorders. And so, but it's really sounding amazing till today, because you know, back in London, we really invented some new sounds then, you know, like the pink noise of the snare. That did not exist before. Good studio work, amazing.
There were some scenes where we needed to have orchestra score, not just songs. And so I told Menachem, I said, you know, I'm going to need to hire an orchestra. And he said, well, who? And I said, how about the London Philharmonic? He said, good, find out how much they cost. So, you know, here I was getting the okay to hire the London Philharmonic. And the day of the big session came, and of course I was scared shitless, but I'd written the music and I knew the music was going to sound good. And I just had never conducted a big orchestra before. I had been conducting in music school and all that, but not, you know, London Philharmonic. And I had this nagging feeling I'd forgotten something, and then I realized I didn't have a baton. So luckily there was a Chinese restaurant two doors down from the recording studio, and I was able to endear a couple of chopsticks, and I still use that chopstick, my lucky chopstick, to this day when I conduct my scores. I don't think we thought about to do instrumentations that were necessarily futuristic. You know, there's one song that You're Made for Me, which is actually very retro, kind of almost late 50s, early 60s style, and then the I'm Coming for You is obviously real mainstream disco. We had to convince Grace Kennedy. She was so embarrassed to sing those lyrics. You know, we had to explain to her, well, it's not you singing them, it's the character singing them. So she eventually agreed that she would sing them, but at the time she was embarrassed. I'm a huge fan of Don Summer, and you know, was at that time and felt like Marauder was just, you know, cutting edge at the moment. So it was cool to go there on that song. You know, I don't think there was any attempt on my part, or Kobe's, or Iris's, to necessarily be futuristic. We just went through to that particular song and make sure that it was coming from the character's point of view, you know, that it wasn't just a hip thing to say, that it would be something that the character would say. Because I think Kobe and I and Iris did a really good job with the music and the lyrics. I think the performances are excellent. And I have to say this about Menachem. I mean, he was able to get it done. And I remember him turning to me and Kobe going, this will be my Tommy. You know, the musical Tommy. This is the way I feel about it. I mean, Menachem was to film directing what a butcher is to a surgeon. You know, they both cut meat. But one has a little more finesse than the other.
When I heard the music, I guess I found it appealing. But I mean, my thought wasn't so deep as to think, I wonder if this will be appealing to other people, you know what I mean, or if this is representative of music going on today. In retrospect, I would say it probably was. you know, probably was kind of the type of music that was popular at that time. You know, at the time, I didn't know what was going on. I was just like, you want me to be in your movie? Okay. And then I'll see what I can do with it from then. There was absolutely zero thought process behind me going into this movie, participating in this movie. I was just like, wow, this truly, I was riding this wave of whatever happens, happens kind of thing. I had nothing to lose. It was sort of fun. We shot in Berlin. And honestly, when I was doing it, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just kind of like showing up every day and having a good time and doing the best I could. I knew the script. I had it memorized. I knew it inside out, you know. But it wasn't even, oh, I'm going to be so prepared that I will memorize the script. It was like, this is so cool. I couldn't put the script down. I kept reading it over and over again, thinking, wow, this is a real movie script. You know, I was young. I was naive, and I was just having a great time. And you know, how it's unfolded over the years and years and years just makes me smile. it's as deep as that.
It all started with a budget of $4 million. And then slowly but surely, like every week, he would go to Germany and get another $1 million from this tax shelters company, a German company. And I remember one time I told him, Menachem, this is not a big movie. It's not a musical per se. He was fixed on what he had in mind. But then on the other hand, he was totally dependent on me. And I was mixing down the soundtrack in London when he already started shooting in Berlin. And the first week he was shooting, he would call me like every day that I should come to Berlin. I said, listen, I got to finish the mixes. You want to have a soundtrack to shoot to? Yeah, and he was totally lost. And it took me about a week to come to Berlin. By then he started shooting with first sequence he shot was with Joss Ackerman. George Gilmore played Alfie, and the creation it was supposed to be a flashback of Alfie when he doesn't want to sign with Boogaloo and everything. But the set was like, you know, there was Joss that was creating Alfie and in heaven and a lot of dinosaurs and that was the first thing I saw when I came to Berlin, and I was, you know, I was shocked. You know, it didn't look that good.
Why are you writing about the apple?
Actor Joss Ackland.
Actually, I've got here my first book I had, first sort of autobiography I did, one did years ago, when I wrote about doing the apple. Shall I read what I wrote in it? It's only a little bit. We shot The Apple in Berlin. It was a rock musical, and I played God. I've played God a few times, actually. It's obviously typecasting. Here is what I took to be the plot. God carves Adam out of a rock. Adam goes down to Earth where he meets Eve. The devil gets her into a nightclub and tempts Adam into evil. God comes down to Earth disguised as an old hippie to keep an eye on things. The old hippie turns around three times, becomes God again, and leads Adam and Eve, lots of young hippies, and Miriam Margolyes back to heaven with the help of Kirby's Flying Ballet. The director was Menachem Golan of Canon Films fame. The cast was a bright bunch of eager youngsters, and Vladek Shebel was the devil. The day before we started shooting, I went across to East Berlin by underground and succeeded in losing my passport. I did not notice until I put my hand in my back pocket at passport control before getting the train back. The passport was not there. Sweating a little, I retraced my steps and searched. This could take 3 months, I thought. The movie could be over. I could be kept in jail. Bad enough to lose a passport in Moscow, but in East Berlin, details would have to go back to Moscow before the ball could start rolling. As a last resort, I went into the main overground station where I'd stopped earlier to ask my way. It was a crowded mass of people. There was a long empty table. Empty except for my passport, the most coveted item in East Berlin. It was so conspicuous that it must have looked like a KGB plant. I picked it up and walked back to the passport control. Filming began in paradise. There were a lot of animals, some real, some phony. I was stuck in a crevice, hacking away at a canvas rock, dressed in white tails and top hat, smoking a pipe, Bing Crosby fashion, and singing, "Behold the wonder I've created, the first of all humanity." There was no room for the camera to edge in amongst the scenery. A tiger escaped. The dinosaur and brontosaurus collapsed because midgets inside their skins were fainting with the heat. Behold the wonder I've created, the first of all humanity. The elephants became embedded in the fragile scenery and were stuck forever, while their trunks flailed at all who came near. Vladek and I did a song and dance routine over the complicated set, which ended with him falling into a stream. We did not look like Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. Menachem was yelling, "Bring back the tiger, bring back the tiger." Paradise is a large portion of the movie. Paradise never made the movie. Menachem was an endearing earlier Hollywood Gregory Ratoff of a director. I never saw the end result. As far as I know, it has never made England in any form. I could work again. That's all I've written about it here.
We did The Apple. I produced it and directed it in Berlin.
Director, Menachem Golan.
We decided not to go to extreme because we had scenes in heaven, you know, in the Garden of Eden, that the young people are going to search through the help of Outland, who was playing God. I mean, to put them play God in the cinema, in a movie, is almost forbiddable. So we had to do some cutting to have the movie somehow accepted. But it didn't work anyway. It didn't work because it was rejected.
He put $1 million just in that sequence, and I said, "Listen, this is ridiculous. This is that's terrible." And there were two good songs that we had to lose because of he cut it out. And so right then I was a little, you know, I didn't know how the plot is gonna work, because at the end of the movie Tops appears. And so who's going to know who Tops is if this sequence in the beginning of the movie is out? And so on one hand, it was, an amazing experience, because there was like 200 extras and dancers that Nigel Lithgow used. He did the choreography and did a great job, I think. And everybody was so, you know, connected, and the vibes on the set were great.
I mean, I enjoyed myself there. I enjoyed being in Berlin. We had a fascinating time, my wife and I. And it was, I was there for some while. But but the movie was, I mean, it was just a joke. It was, and I was very fond of Menachem Golan, actually, because he was so bizarre, you know, and so very much of the old school of just putting a movie together. And who was it? Globus was the partner, isn't it? You know, he could have been a banker. Could have been a banker today, for God.
Got to be an actor. I acted in the movie as well, along with Kobe. I played I played a reporter. I played a clown in the showbiz sequence that says something about "See the incredible shrinking man." That was me. And then that was me acting. And then also I played the hunchback who gives the apple to Bibi during the hell scene, during the apple in hell scene. So, you know, it was a hoot being in Berlin for that period of time, and actually getting to put on a costume and do all this stuff. So it was a great opportunity.
Well, he kind of put a lot of all kinds of roles in it to make it a little bit more acceptable, maybe a little bit less sharp, like the Jewish landlady, for example, things like that, to make it a little bit more, you know, kitschy. I don't know how to call it.
And I'll tell you another story. There's a sequence in it. Miriam Margolyes came over for one day shooting on this movie. And it was at the end of the movie when I'm taking everybody back to heaven by care of Kirby's Flying Ballet. So we all went up and were taken up into the air, and I, with my hands aloft and the and wings sprouting and things, and all the people falling. But meanwhile, the American army were all in Berlin at the time, and they were there. Because they were occupying where we were shooting, and so they got them all in to be the as extras, and they still stood below. And Miriam Margolyes was up in this balloon with a fella, a young fella, doing it. And we were all floating up to heaven. And the balloon suddenly stopped. And Menachem was yelling up, move the balloon, move the balloon, move the balloon. And Miriam Margolyes looked out, and all the army were looking up. And he said, come on, move. And she said, I'm not moving another inch unless he tosses me off. And the whole of the American army's jaws dropped open. They couldn't believe what they were seeing.
Nothing like that was in the original. I mean, that's Menachem Golan's, solution to something that couldn't be actually, didn't have a solution.
It was a great kind of boot camp experience in terms of learning the business. There was such integrity and passion and love behind this movie. And Menachem and Yoram were behind it thinking this is going to just, like, I don't know, break all sorts of records and establish this amazing genre and all this other stuff. Menachem, you know, he's kind of a bulldog. He's pretty, he knows what he wants and he doesn't put up with any crap. One time, we were shooting in Berlin. This was in West Berlin before the wall was down. And West Berlin was a crazy place. It was like a circus. It was like you could go to the raunchiest clubs. It was just a fun place to be. I mean, I didn't do crazy stuff. I've never been really a crazy person. But I did stay out all night one night. And I misread my call time for the next day. And so I was, like, late for my call time because I'd been out all night, and I literally hadn't slept. And Menachem came down to the makeup room, and he was so mad because, of course, if I was the lead in this thing, and you don't hold up production. It's expensive. He came down to the makeup room as I was getting makeup to cover up the bags under my eyes. He was like, you will never work in this industry again! And I was just like, it freaked me out, of course, but I was like, wow, that sounds so cliche. He was so mad at me. So, I mean, he was, you know, he wasn't like a super fun-loving guy, but he knew what he wanted, and, you know, he'd directed some pretty serious movies in his day, so he was a good director, but there wasn't a lot of frivolity on the set. But there was a lot of fun people, like all the dancers were so great, so much fun to hang around. And all the actors really got along well, too. So on that level, it was great. And again, I was just riding this wave of, like, what the heck is going on? And isn't this so cool? You know, it was really fun. I hung out with Joss Ackland one time. He and I went to East Berlin together. That was fascinating. One day we took a train past Checkpoint Charlie and all that other junk and went into East Berlin and kind of wandered around. And, man, that was a depressing place. Very gray. It was just sort of lifeless. A lot of concrete, not a lot of trees, and people weren't very happy particularly. And Joss Ackland misplaced his passport there. I forget how that all resolved itself, but that was pretty wild. I mean, I hung out with Vladek Shabal as well. I wasn't aware of what he'd done before, but he was a very, very, very professional, and he took it all very seriously. He took his character incredibly seriously. You know, he influenced the makeup and costumes and that little horn that was on his head when he was the devil. Was that even in the movie, the final version? Yeah, the fantasy. Yes, of course, where we do the whole apple dance thing in hell. I mean, the one horn that was all, he didn't want two horns, he only wanted one horn. And he was very specific about how he wanted to play his character, which was interesting for me to watch. For me also, I was just taking everything in like a sponge, you know, just watching how everything was done, including the acting. And he was very interesting to watch. Joss Ackland was just this kind old guy who, you know, obviously he took what he was doing very seriously too. These were high-level professional actors that I was working with. Miriam Margolis was in it. She was amazing. I just adored her. She fascinated me. I couldn't stop watching her because she was such a character. Radek was a very interesting character, very professional, very precise about what he did on film, and very sort of mysteriously flamboyant off screen. I remember he had, I don't know what it was, this was a long time ago, but he had some collection, he liked to collect perfumes. And I just was like, that's very interesting. Okay, I'll go with that. George Gilmore, well, lovely man, so good looking. As somebody said that in one of these reviews that I was reading, couldn't imagine having tighter pants on. And in the play, the live version that they do of the Apple, they kind of accentuate that fact, which is very funny. He was a lovely, lovely man. Yeah, and I don't know what happened to him. We stayed in touch. I went back to London and lived for a little while longer after the Apple, and he and I kept in touch for a little while longer. But then when I moved to the States, we just sort of lost touch.
My helplessness with Menachem on the set was bothering me because, you know, we used to see the rushes every day. And I knew that there was a lot of great stuff that how would he edit it, like the opening of the movie with the Do the BIM with the World Vision Festival. We shot it for 5 days in a row, and David Garfunkel did the cinematography, the photography that held the camera on hand, and there were shots there when I saw the rushes, like for the whole 5 days, you know, there was so much amazing stuff there, because you know, it was a problem. We had a lot of amazing data that was cut out, and Menachem wouldn't let me be present in the editing, because, you know, I'm a perfectionist, and it takes time, and he knew that if I'm there, it'll take time, and I'll have a lot to say, and he didn't need that to, but I have to say in his favor that, you know, the original editor that he hired was my best friend at that time, Dov Hanig, a real genius, and a very intelligent person, and he really connected to the Apple of the Orwellian version, and so he, I counted on him, and he was in the rushes every day with us. So there was Menachem and Garfunkel, photographer, you know, and me and Dov sitting behind. And it was, you know, one time that Dov couldn't stand it, what he saw, and it was a little out of focus and a little dark, and it was not lighted well, and he said it, and he said to Menachem, it said, it's out of focus. And the next day, I woke up and Dov was not there. That was a real shock for me, because I really counted on him. But then I have to say Menachem's favor that he hired Alanya Kubovich. The main good thing about the movie is the editing, because it was really, the cuts are so fast, and there was no MTV then, in really MTV style. Yeah, did a good job, Alan. But then, you know, a lot of amazing data was not used, especially the ending of the movie, which was very weird. And, you know, when I saw that, I was really shocked.
all our stuff was cut out of the movie anyway, I believe, because God, heaven wasn't in the movie, was it? I mean, heaven was half, was three-quarters of the script. I mean, that's the whole point of the movie. I don't understand what can be left.
The end of the film is so strange, isn't it? He's a good movie maker, and he's done a lot to the movie industry in Israel and maybe also in LA. But yeah, he was not generous, to say the least, with us. Yeah, he kind of took also the credit for the story, the script, which is also not true.
You're dealing with Menachem, who is sort of a madman and not renowned for his generosity. The premiere screening that I attended was at MGM Studios in the big screen theater there. And there was, you know, it was interesting. Menachem had invited a lot of Hollywood. This was going to be his big moment. And about 20 minutes into the film, I guess he was unhappy with the projection or the sound or something, because he jumped up and started screaming, "Stop! Stop the film! Stop the film!" And so they stopped it, and he said that it was, you know, technically something was wrong and had to be fixed, and then they restarted it again. And there were people who, you know, didn't appreciate the film and left during the actual screening, but I don't recall a near riot.
It was in Cannes, in the festival back in 80. It was a bizarre film, you know, to watch, especially then. And I remember at the end of the movie with the credits and everything, I got the standing ovation for the music. A lot of people that I appreciate were there, like Arnold Milchin. People loved it. The people who was in the premiere in Cannes in 80 loved the music and were a little shocked of the visuals, you know. It was very bizarre and rich and bizarre and weird, but you know, you could see that all the $10 million that he put on screen, you could see that for sure. But you could always hear the amazing budget for the soundtrack.
It opened the Montreal Film Festival in 1980 or something like that. And they opened this movie in Montreal. And
in the middle of the film, after the beginning, the crowd, which was mostly young people, started to boo. And many left the theater in the middle. I was so miserable, and so I was with my wife and with my partner, Johann Globus, and I was so hurt. I didn't understand what's wrong with the film that they reacted like that. And I ran in the middle of the film to my hotel, which was opposite the theater. And on the 8th floor, I was living there in a suite on the 8th floor. And I went to the balcony. I decided to jump. I wanted to commit suicide. It's a true fact. A true fact. But Yoram Globus, my partner, ran after me and grabbed me by the shoulder, said, "Menachem, there will be other films. Relax." The film was never played, and we didn't open it anywhere for about 30 years.
When it came about, you know, when it was out there, nobody was talking about it. Nobody showed it to nobody, and it was just like nothing happened. So it's very nice for me to hear now that people do talk about it a little. It's really surprising.
Well, I remember there was a bad movie club that used to pick a movie, and I think, and screen it at midnight here in one of the theaters in Los Angeles, and they actually contacted me and asked me if I wanted to come down to introduce the Apple to the audience at the midnight showing of the Apple at the Bad Movie Club. And I was busy, wasn't able to go down at that time, but I was surprised that there were people interested in it, you know, even to the point of going and singing the lyrics along with it like they do for Rocky Horror Picture Show.
What shocks and amazes me is the longevity of this thing. You know, they did a screening of it at Lincoln Center here in New York. Somebody about 10 years ago called me up from Entertainment Weekly or something and said, "Did you know that this is like this cult movie?" And I'd sort of been kind of on the periphery of the business for a while because I was raising my kids and all that stuff. And I was like, what? Is this even possible? And it's shocking, and it just makes me smile.
We hear that it became a cult movie in the village in New York. We didn't believe this is possible. Apparently, it caught almost every midnight theater where youth are going to movies and became a cult movie in America. And from then on, some festivals asked for it, etc., etc. And all of a sudden, a movie that was dead, completely dead, and that was rejected in the year that we did it, is all of a sudden people are interested in it and like it, especially young people of today. As you know, in New York, they did a week for Cannon and Yoram and me, and they showed the movie. And what was amazing to me is that the crowd was a full house, and they all sang the songs, they knew the songs of the movie. And all of them sang it with the screening. I was so amazed how the people liked it so much. The youth, people, kids, you know, from 16 to 30. And it's amazing, amazing what this movie went through. It's a new generation today, and I call it that it was before its time.
This movie was ahead of its time, that's for sure, because it was not successful, to say the least. It was really a big flop. Only now, maybe the last years or so, people start to get interested in it. It's very funny for me. It's very strange. So 30 years ago, we had a good concept of the way, let's say, good and evil work in the world, or Satan and God and the producers and the managers and all this show business thing going on. And it was, I think, because we were living at that time in Europe and we were having some troubled time trying to get our creations to be published in Amsterdam and in Paris. And we probably met the same problems that Alfie and Bibi were meeting in the movie.
I'm proud of this movie because of, I know the integrity and the passion that was behind it. And it may have been misguided in many ways. And, you know, people joke about how awful it is and how bad it is. But it was, man, it didn't do anything bad for me, and it's still around. And there's a reason for that, you know. And I don't think the least of that is the fact that there was so, you feel the passion behind this movie. So he put a lot of money and love into it. Both of them did.
But altogether, you know, you cannot argue with facts. This is 32 years later, and this sort of comeback to this, you know, it was a failure. It was a flop, you know, on the screens when it was released in 80. But the fact that it came back, and it's a phenomenon. So for me to say, you know, bad things about this movie is a lot of bullshit. Yeah, you know, because the impact that it has on the kids today, you know, like this music was written 32 or 33 years back. So what else could a composer want? You know, this is really an amazing satisfaction.
And of course, you know what Kobe is very frustrated about is that we got no royalties at all, no money at all out of this movie, nothing. He is trying, I think maybe to this day, he's trying to use some lawyers to do that, and nothing is not successful. I gave up. I mean, I just told him, if you do anything and you need my help, that's fine, but I'm not going to do anything about it because I know how much you have to pay to lawyers to do that, and then you get nothing in the end, you know, they get it all. So it's a bit like what the movie talks about. It's actually a bit what we experienced, that the money people are taking it all, and you got you who are the idealist and think about love will conquer all and love will be the cure, you just get nothing.
This is a red light for a lot of ripped off artists, composers and creators that, you know, that I never knew that MGM allegedly owned this movie and released it on a DVD in 2004. I just found out through the web 3 years later, and I was shocked that it was released on a DVD, and it's becoming a cult movie. And ever since, you know, I went to L.A. to see it with my own eyes, and I really saw it. It's becoming a cult. And you know, hired this this attorney, IP attorney over there, and took him 6 months to come back with no answer from MGM. Did not want to pay anything, even though, you know, I never signed anything with them. And never have I assigned any of my intellectual property copyrights to them, or nor to Canon, because I've been fighting with them over this shameful case of, you know, endless ongoing rip off that this is the fruit of my intellectual property, and they should not have it all to themselves. I mean, there's a law, and especially that I put a complaint against them just for releasing the DVD in 2004, according to the DMCA law. You know, you cannot transfer the old media into new media without not even letting the owner of the multiple copyrights know, or go come to a clearance deal or whatever. Nothing helped. And finally, you know, well, my greatest surprise was that Menachem wrote this declaration under oath in which he said to MGM that he's willing to come a witness, and the guy's 84, that I never assigned any of the copyright of the movie, not even to Golan Globus, who originally produced it, especially not the can, because the only thing that I assigned was my copyrights in the Hebrew version that was not connected to the English version. And then, you know, this honorable judge Barbara Crabb that runs the court in Wisconsin where I started with my first complaint, she published on the web like 19 pages of her jurisdiction, all in my favor. And and since then MGM started to worry and hired the Slobo Lobo office with this, the attorney that represented them, who lied to the court under oath, terrible lies, and you know, finally they transferred my case to L.A., you know, where I became a pro se. I could not hire a local IP attorney. Finally, I did not get a thing. So until today, this is not shameful. This is a terrible scandal, you know, because, you know, I told you what, there was an interview that I did on one of the newspapers in Israel, and I told it to the reporter that, let's say, you know, another 80% of the composers were supposed to be going through what I've been going through and fight for their rights and have no time to write new things. And that you know, it's just Damocles said, the day the music died. That's the way to kill music. So you know, I'm sitting helpless, and it's my music and my screenplay, my story, and nothing at all, and they just ignore it. So this is really, I mean, if you go into details of the last 4 or 5 years, it's unheard of, and it's MGM. So you know, the people ought to know about it. You know, there's an end to ripping off artists. So, you know, so many people love this movie. Who would have ever guessed that the creator did not get, you know, part of his fruit back?
Like a puppet on the string, like a monkey on a swing, man is clinging to the ropes of the fantasies and hopes we are dangling. He's so eager to believe and so easily deceived. Like a baby watching magic, he's so gullible, it's tragic in the word naive.
Life is nothing but show business, In 1994, we fight for the spotlight. We care for our core. Life is nothing but show business, the world's a cabaret. We live for the fortune, we die for the fame.
All right, welcome back to the Projection Booth. It was really great talking to so many people involved with the production of The Apple. The film's really gained a bit of a cult following over the years, partially due to the futuristic sets and costumes. But yeah, the sets and everything are just absolutely incredible. I love this kind of futuristic. To me, that's one of the biggest points of hilarity to me, is that this is all set in this kind of 1994. And then talking to Reich, we found out that he actually wanted it to be set in 84, kind of going back to the Orwellian thing, which makes a little bit more sense, even though I still think it would be funny when you're watching this movie and they're talking about this futuristic land of 1984, especially any time past 1984, even past 1980, but I could see it being kind of, a little bit more of a metaphorical kind of thing rather than this kind of literal 1994 that they seem to be setting up. So let's talk a little bit more about the making of the film and the actual, we've alluded to the ending before, but God, that sounds absolutely crazy. Talking to Joss Ackland, it sounds like they had dwarves in dinosaur costumes that were dying from the heat as they were trying to have this whole set of creation and what it was like in heaven. So again, giving kind of short shrift to the good side of the movie and really kind of continuing on that whole playing up of the evil side in the movie. So guys, what did you think about the sets, the songs? Let's get back into the discussion here. Dan, tell me what you thought about the music.
I thought the music was really catchy, and I enjoyed them quite a bit.
You know, it's hard to say with a straight face, but I do have problems with the music in The Apple. The folk songs are rather generic, and, you know, they have lyrics like, "Love's the universal melody." And I had to wonder if, you know, the folk songs are at a level of parody, but I feel like they might actually be rather sincere. Any song that Mr. Boogaloo sings, I adore. I think that the song Show Business actually has a Les Mis quality to its chorus. Definitely the most memorable. Les Mis, by the way, came out that same year. The theatricality of that song kind of makes it the most memorable on the soundtrack, outside of the title song, of course.
Once you hear it, that song gets stuck in your head for way too long.
It's very Rocky Horror-esque.
It is.
Both the number and the song itself.
Going back, you know, we're talking about Nigel Lithgow's choreography of all the songs and everything, of all the musical numbers, the dancing. Some of those are just so clunky. I wonder what a Nigel Lithgow of 2012 would be saying to the Nigel Lithgow of 1980 about some of the dancers in that film. I have to ask you guys, do you like this film? And I'll start with you, Eric. Do you like this film truly, or do you like it ironically?
There's a lot to like ironically. I'd say about, I wouldn't go as far as 50%, but, you know, 30% of the film I think is legitimately interesting, at least visually. You know, it's one of those films that kind of teeters on the edge of being legitimately good and legitimately bad. And those are the things that, you know, great films are made of, so...
I have to go 100% ironically, because like it's just I was just watching it, and there were points of this, like I was watching it on the train with my iPad, and there were points where I actually turned my screen away from people because I didn't want them to see what I was watching, because I was like, this borderline looks like gay porno sometimes. I mean, it's just so weird and so garish and so like over the top. I was like, wow.
I think it comes across for a lot of people as intentional camp. I think, you know, those people approach it from a different way than we do, you know, knowing the film's background.
Sounds like the people in 1980, not so happy with the film, because they there wasn't all these years between the film and now where we can look back at it ironically and enjoy it for that way.
Well, if you're like a diehard Christian, I could see this as very offensive on a lot of levels.
I don't know if Christians would get offended by it or like be happy with it, because, you know, really it's kind of this kind of rapture film for them, you know, talking about how you shouldn't sell out to the devil and, you know, how these people that give in so easily are all dupes and all this stuff. It reminds me when I was a kid, there was some crazy guy going around my neighborhood with all these like homemade pamphlets all about the mark of the beast and all this, and how you're going to have the mark of the beast if you want to get gasoline, and how it's, you know, 666 is the number of some sort of international bank number and blah, blah, blah. And I'm wondering if he would be like, yeah, yeah, this is what I'm talking about when he's watching the movie, or if he would get offended and be like, no, no, they handled this completely wrong. Because really, you know, the good guys went out at the end and they get to take off in that awesome car in the sky. Yeah.
Mr. Tops.
And the film does have a rather reassuring message. I mean, it's saying that if you live in poverty for long enough, you'll be taken to a new planet. I mean, Mr. Tops, you know, will come down and save you from your impoverished life. I mean, I think it, you know, it gives believers, you know, a bit of reassurance.
Yeah, I always wonder what that transformation scene from, you know, leader of the hippies to Mr. Tops himself would have looked like, you know, having Jos Acklin play both, because it really kind of misses something when you don't put the two together that they are the same person.
Do they ever establish the relationship between the two leads?
Between Alfie and BB, or between Mr. Tops and Mr. Boogaloo?
Between Alfie and BB, because, you know, immediately BB is making out with another guy, and Alfie seems to feel jealous, but maybe he's just angry that she's, you know, starting to sell out.
Are you thinking they might be brother and sister?
That's what I thought the first time I saw this film, until the end when they get married.
I thought the same thing. But
I could totally see that.
It's just strange that they, you know, they came down from Canada and they're a folk singing duo and, you know, they're just friends.
Yeah, because they kind of reminded me a little bit of the Carpenters. And I was always very surprised when the Carpenters were brother and sister and not husband and wife.
Exactly.
I did some research and I found on this weird like forum, this guy claiming to be one of the gentlemen who actually wrote the music, and how the director ripped him off, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy for a long while, and it was kind of funny. Kobe and Iris, the two people that wrote the lyrics for this originally, and I guess, you know, Kobe wrote the music for it, they kind of got themselves into their own Mr. Boogaloo situation when they dealt with Menachem Golan. And I was very glad to hear from Kobe Reck that that relationship has been fixed, and that Golan has gone out of his way now to say that they wrote the songs and wrote the lyrics and, you know, really basically wrote the entire script. Because I know that that was a huge sore point for a lot of years, that Kobe and Iris only get story credit and they don't get any kind of screenplay credit, and they don't really get a whole lot more than that. So it's, yeah, that was definitely a sore point for them. But yeah, it's kind of ironic. You write this musical about making a deal with the devil, and then you turn around and you make a deal with the devil.
I found like two or three posts from Iris on the internet on various Apple sites saying the exact same thing.
I was actually thinking about Menachem as the bad guy in the whole story. But when Kobe was talking about how devastated Menachem was by the film's, you know, negative reception, like so devastated, in fact, that he contemplated suicide, I actually found that rather endearing and kind of elevated his status in my mind.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was glad to hear that. And I was glad to hear it sounds like there was a screening of The Apple that actually finally brought Golan and his cousin Globus back together. So now that they're friends again after all these years. So seems like The Apple's doing some good in the world here.
Sure. And it's had, you know, some very successful screenings in recent years at places like the Silent Movie Theater in L.A. and the Alamo Draft House down in Austin.
Which is weird, too, because, and I've been trying to get a hold of some of the folks that have seen this, that it's a different print that runs on 35 millimeter than what we're seeing on DVD and what was on VHS for a lot of years. It sounds like MGM, they shipped an early version of the film to these locations. And so there's this different version out there that's going around that has a little bit more at the end. It still doesn't have the dinosaurs and stuff, but it's got a little bit more to it. And actually, makes a little bit more sense, not a whole lot more. But then there's also, I read someplace that like some of the choruses go on for just way too long. So some of these songs are just like, okay, end already, would ya?
Yeah, one deleted scene that it includes is the wedding scene, which would actually help the ending of the film a great deal, because it doesn't just simply jump ahead, you know, a year or whatever it is, 2 years, and suddenly the two leads have a baby. I think with that wedding scene, it establishes that whole concept, you know, much better.
I think you can see a little bit of the wedding scene in the original preview to it.
Yes.
So it's always weird when you see stuff in the previews that just aren't in the final film, especially what I would think is a pretty important scene like that.
Doesn't it also contain the creation song?
Yeah, the creation scene. I think, yeah, both the songs that got cut were both in it.
I know that there's not enough interest, unfortunately, in the Apple to merit another release on DVD, but wouldn't that be awesome if maybe like on the Blu-ray or something, they suddenly said, okay, well, here's the version you're used to and here's the extra stuff, even if they had it just as an extra scene kind of supplement to the film. I mean, I feel that we've done a lot more research in talking about the Apple today and getting these interviews and all this kind of stuff than MGM did when they put out the disc, because it was just kind of like this bare bones, here you go, that's it, you know. But they really should have done it up a little bit more, because I think the story behind the Apple is almost as interesting as the film itself.
You know, a year ago, I would never have expected the Apple to come out on Blu-ray. But after the release of the Mexican Santa Claus a couple months ago.
And the upcoming release of Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Yeah, exactly. It's like anything is possible now. We're living in exciting times.
Pretty soon we will all have our own BIM marks. And I want to thank, when I was posting out online that we were going to do this episode of The Apple, this guy, George Hickman, who had done a screening of the Apple in Austin. I'm not sure if it's the one that we were talking about with the different version of the print, but he actually made up BIM marks for the audience and sent those along to me. And unfortunately, they just arrived yesterday, or else I would have sent you guys your own BIM marks that you can have. But, you know, send me your addresses and I'll send you some BIM marks. They just need a little bit of double-sided tape or crazy glue, depending on how into this movie you are, and you just slap it on your forehead. So I'm wearing my BIM mark right now and nothing else. So I just wanted to give you guys that mental picture.
I'll be joining you soon.
This movie scared me just a little bit. No, wait, I loved Can't Stop the Music. I just think this took it to a whole new level where it was just a little bit, like you said, it's a little bit scary.
Okay, that's all we have time for this week. I want to thank my guests again. Dan, what kind of good stuff is happening over at Geekadelphia.com?
I'm just doing the standard interviews with different celebrities and directors and whatnot. And I also run a lot of contests if you live in the Philadelphia area for free movie tickets. So you can check me out for that.
Very cool. And thanks to my other Delphia friend, Eric. What should folks be going over to Cinadelphia.com for?
They should come over to read the usual copious amounts of Philadelphia film news and gossip, mainstream movie bashing, and interviews with B-level celebrities and local weirdos. Fun for everyone, regardless of where you live.
Excellent. All right, well, thanks a lot, my friends Adelphias. And thanks to everyone for listening to the show. Catch more of The Projection Booth at iTunes, Stitcher, or via the website projection-booth.com. So now let's head out to that big Cadillac in the sky.
Mystery Apple, take a little ride. Let me be your guide through the apple paradise. Juju Apple, Voodoo Apple, take a little bite. Spend a splendid night in our garden of delights. It's a natural, natural, natural desire. Meet an actual, actual, actual vampire. Paralyzed, so you'll be victimized. You're fascinated, captivated, losing your mind. When we cross the apple eye on you. Holy apple, sacred apple, take a little chance, get into a trance, and join me in the apple dance. Whoa. Go, go.
Anyways, so what else do you want to know about the apple?